This is Global Torah, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service. I'm Shani Rosenbaum, your host and program manager at Olam. In Jewish tradition, prayer is called avodah, service. Yet in the modern day, we often associate service with volunteering, advocating, devoting our time and energy to strengthening the most vulnerable communities in our world. In today's episode, we explore the relationship between these two kinds of service. Where is the intersection between Jewish spiritual practice and social action? What are the connections between serving God and serving humanity? Joining us to delve into these questions are two living models of Jewish service in action. Rabbi Micha Odenheimer, founder and director of the Jewish-Israeli International Development Organization, Tevel Betzedek, and Rabbi Ruth Gunn Kagan, founder and spiritual leader of Navat Yilah, a Jerusalem-based NGO devoted to Jewish renewal. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I want to get started hearing a little bit about each of your early lives with relationship to both spirituality and social justice. Think back, what are your memories of how social action and social justice played into your early identity and how spirituality played into your early identity?
So I grew up in a in the Orthodox community in Los Angeles and in the 1960s. And at that time, there was very much a feeling of being a minority. It wasn't okay then in the United States to be different. And also our community was mostly made up of, my friends were mostly children of Holocaust survivors. My father was a refugee from Germany. Most of my friends had at least one parent that had survived the camps or had hidden or so on and so forth. So I had a very deep sense of being outside the mainstream of, you know, sort of white America, which really was the public America at that time, and a feeling that that's part of what it meant to be Jewish, was to be outside the mainstream. And we were, yes, we were becoming more successful, but our identification with the poor, with blacks, Mexicans, et cetera, was at that time very, very strong. And I remember for many years we didn't eat ice cream because all of a sudden ice cream wasn't kosher. But at the same time, you know, without hashgacha, and there was no hashgacha there, but at the same time, we didn't eat lettuce and grapes for many years because my mom said the farm workers are striking, the migrant farm workers, and Jews don't do that. We don't break strikes. So for me, those two things were really deeply connected. And in general, that was the Jewish community at that time was very strongly identified with social policies that were pro-poor and pro-minority. Very different, I think, than Orthodoxy today. But somehow that stuck with me. Yeah.
Thanks.
I grew up in Israel in the 60s, the same like Micha, in family of Shoah survivors and my father got here before the war, but was one of the ma'apilim, the illegal immigrant, kept in camp by the British, then released. And I grew up modern Orthodox, what was now then Bnei Akiva in the budding state. And I was never a minority. I never felt like a minority in my Jewish identity. At the same time, helping the poor and the needy was always part of our culture because this is what, the same way, this is what Jews do, not breaking strikes or, but here, you know, everybody was Jewish at the time. And 67 I was already like, you know, I was already older. But it took us some time to figure out that we're not just Jews here. And that's a different story for a different podcast.
So both of you, in your own way, are spiritual leaders and practicers of Jewish spiritual life. So I'm curious for each of you, is there a unique Jewish approach to spiritual connection or spiritual practice? And how would you describe that approach?
So one of the interesting things that we notice about Hebrew, especially biblical Hebrew, is that it's all made out of pe'alim, of verbs. And there's very little time devoted to the inner life in the Bible, describing the Bible. And this is the theory I learned from an Israeli writer, Asaf Inbari. He exposed that. He even wrote a novel that's also in this idiom. Always just what's happened. And the way I understand it Jewishly is that it's not that people don't have feelings and not that they don't have inner reflections, but it all starts from the doing and go back for the doing, Naseh v'nishma. And there is this thing, like they said, why isn't there a bracha on giving tzedakah to the poor? Because of course you have to give tzedakah to the poor. So why isn't there a bracha? He said, by the time you think of the bracha, you say the bracha, the men will die of hunger. So there is a sense of like the doing is important. And this in itself, it will reflect back into the building of your personality and your spirituality. Your spirituality cannot just be in what you think and what you feel. It has to be invested in what you do.
So spiritual practice in the Jewish tradition is action.
Not just. But I think that I just brought the I'm not saying it's just. I just wanted to make a sense. Like, you know, I have the Christian friends, and for them, faith is very, very important. I know extremely devoted Jewish people who might even be keeping mitzvot. And they said, you know, I worked out this belief thing. I can't believe in God, but I'm not going to stop doing what the thing is according to my tradition. If you were a Christian, it would be more difficult. You really would need to, it would be sent back to the, to check in your faith again and again and work on your faith. And we said, you know, as long as you do, okay, we'll accept that as a bona fide Jewish being.
Thanks. Micha, what's your sense of a unique Jewish approach to spirituality?
I would say that a few things. First of all, that for us, you know, obviously there are many streams in Judaism. Judaism is a whole civilization. But for me, a very basic thing is this idea that we are trying to create a dwelling place for God in this world. We're trying to bring God all the way down to this world. So I see it metaphorically as like Buddhism and Hinduism. They're at the foothills of the Himalayas, these great mountains rising up so far into the sky that human beings couldn't even live there, whereas our holy place is a little hill atop the rising out from the lowest place on earth, because we're supposed to bring God down into every cell of our, you know, every cell of our body, every low place. So that's one thing. And where this idea of God as so transcendent that there really is no difference between the physical and the spiritual, that there's really is a union. The physical is also spiritual. And also this idea that is in Judaism, that as much as we're totally in God's hands, God is also kivayachol, he's also in our hands. We can raise him up, we can raise up what God is, or we can, God forbid, bring down God. So that idea that in fact heaven itself is dynamic. God will not enter and sit in his throne in the heavens above until Jerusalem is built below. In Jerusalem, I mean the whole world. So that's also, I think, key. Another thing is our idea of karma. Whereas a Hindu, obviously there are many different kinds of Hindus, but I don't want to make a straw man, but a Hindu might look at a poor person or a person who's suffering and say, okay, that's his karma. For us, it's very clear from the mystical tradition that the karma of individuals is also affected by the sort of field of goodness or evil that's created in this world. So if there's a field of evil created, then the scales in which the souls are weighed and sent down into the world, they themselves get screwed up. So we can never look at a poor person and say that it's, you know, that it's his fault. And I think these are all very unique parts. And then the last thing is that I think for Judaism, pretty uniquely, critical thinking is part of our spirituality. So trying to understand the underlying reasons for things. So one example for me is in the Gemara and Megillah. So they have this whole thing about what is Tein Talu Matar Livracha, the prayer for rain. Seems to be the most simple physical prayer. And they say, no, you know what that is? That's a prayer against speculators who will try to raise the price of food. Because if there's not enough rain and there seems to be a chisaron, there seems to be not enough food, they'll have a way to manipulate the market. So this idea of critical thinking, also about economics and social society, is also part of our spirituality.
I want to add something to this. We have a saying, starts with the Gemara, continue with the Zohar, and with Hasidut, is that Shekhinah is where the suffering person is. God is with the suffering. God is where the sick people are. God is, Shekhinah goes to Galut and stays with where suffering is. So when we're looking at a suffering person, not only we can't say, oh, it's his or her fault, but we is like, oh, if there's a suffering person, God is there. So that's what I need to respect. That's what I need to support. In this way, I will raise the Godhead up. Then this I will create a olam be malchut Shaddai. So Shekhinah will be in malchut. She will be, the Shekhinah meaning it's another name of God in the feminine, but it's a name of in a name of God. So it will like she will be reinstituted to reigning. And how do we do that? By alleviating the suffering, because that's her suffering.
I'm curious, you mentioned, Micha, sort of the concept of bringing God into the world. Can you think of a moment in your work where you felt like you felt or experienced that happening?
One thing that I try to impress upon people who are coming, you know, one of my classes, people who are coming to volunteer, is that there's an interesting dynamic where, on the one hand, we look at everybody, we see their Tzelem Elohim, you know? We see that everybody has Tzelem Elohim. But the idea of Tzelem Elohim is actually dynamic.
So and Tzelem Elohim
means? Tzelem Elohim means the image of God, that men are created in the image of God. So you might think the image of God, that means that it's static. It's something from God, and you have it. But the truth is that we so deeply affect each other that if we give each other honor and respect and love and attention, we actually expand that field called the Tzelem Elohim, the image of God. It's like a shining or a field. And I've experienced that many times where if one is able to give other people honor and to make space for them, then you can actually see them beginning to shine.
Mm. I guess that sense of bringing God down, I mean, I work with some people who are atheists. But that kind of sense of Hashra'at HaShchina, of like the divine spirit coming down, when we talk about how does it feel physically, viscerally, people can have it even if they call themselves atheists, because God, according to what I learned it from my 12-step students, it's like God is whatever you call God. So let's not fight about what God is. If you call something God, let's call it God, as you understand it. So that kind of sense of the spirit is touching. I think what I said before about Shekhinah being with the sick. Many times when you go visit people just before they die, we feel that kind of sense, like holiness, that certain hush or certain heart opening, and it can, you can feel it by the end of a good work day in. It could be in a field growing, or it could be in relief work. But that kind of working together for building. We mentioned the term tikkun olam, and I said really tikkun is not fixing. Tikkun, it's an original sense, is building. Letaken is lehatkin, is to build. And I see in all that work that is done in relief projects around the world, it's like, the ones that are really working is when people, both local people and helping people, are working together to build something new together. So we're all invested, whether in prayer, if we come in prayer, and we invested in the prayer that's happening, if we're coming together and invested in building something together, then very often we feel that kind of sense of bringing the divine down to be between us. And I would say that if the two are studying together, or it also said about a couple, Shekhinah Benehem. So the minimum to feel the God between you is two people. So we can create that in when we interact with each other, not just at Tzelem Elohim. And Baal Shem Tov says, and the Piazetzner Rebbe following him, he said, when you are building this kind of eyes and you are building this kind of holy body, when you look at the olam, when you look at the world, you see God, but you also sense that God is looking at you. So that is kind of a whole shift. Like when I'm helping those people I think, like, you know, oh, I look at them and I'll see God in them. Suddenly it's like, okay, you know, it's not just about you being able to see things. It's not just about you. It's not just your ego and you're helping. Suddenly you realize that God is looking at you through the eyes of the other people or through the trees or through other things that are around. So that manifesting of God's presence is not difficult. It's not just do it. It just pay attention to what you're doing and do it together. Do it together.
I'm Shani Rosenbaum. You're listening to Rabbi Ruth Gahn-Kagan and Rabbi Micha Odenheimer on Global Torah. I wanted to think a little bit for a minute about sort of different models or modes of prayer and spirituality, particularly mindfulness and meditation, for example, often has within it a sense of the value of acceptance, the value of sitting, the value of attention, versus my experience growing up in the Jewish world echoes something that you mentioned, Ruth, which was sort of action, moving, right? The words that we get from the Bible are all verbs. Do you experience that tension within as Jewish practicers and also practicers of spirituality between movement and quiet, between movement and sitting, between acceptance and non-acceptance of the status quo? And kind of how do you navigate and live in that tension?
First of all, I think that sometimes people compare, like if you would you compare your experience in a congregation in the United States with, you know, sort of like with now mindfulness and so on, it's sort of like taken the best of what Buddhism is. Like if you take popular Buddhism in Thailand or in, you know, most of the places where Buddhism exists, it's more like pouring water over the Buddha, doing prostrations, doing this, you know. But somehow Buddhism on a very high level, which is a great thing, has come to the United States as mindfulness, whereas Judaism on a very high level, I think, also contains many different kinds of practices, but they are becoming more and more, you know, they're becoming more and more available. So I would say that on the one hand. I also think that for Judaism, there is a value in brokenheartedness. Like Rabbi Nachman says, you know, be happy the whole day, be besimcha, because only when you're besimcha can God really inhabit you and, you know, really open up to you and you can really be in the moment. But take 1 hour a day and express yourself and your brokenheartedness. And you know, when you were just saying about the Torah, I think it's true that there's a lot of action in the Torah, but then if you take the Tehillim, so there's like five books of Tehillim, there's five books of the Torah. Tehillim is traditionally divided into five books. So those are like the five, the Psalms. So those are like the tears that you shed. That's all about emotion, the Tehillim. It's like almost all emotion. It's like the tears you're shedding in order to understand the Torah. So I think that also, that's a different kind of value than the stillness, but it's something else. And it's something that, you know, connects you, I think, to the suffering in the world, but also brings you through it to a point of transcendence and to contact with God through this brokenheartedness.
Thanks.
I made a connection between sit and Shabbat, which is Shabbat comes from the verb lashevet, to sit, and also to stop. So to sit is really to stop. I was conducting a levaya, a funeral yesterday, and it was the end of the day. And after, we were all standing for a long time. And then I invited the people who avilim. I said, you know, this is really the mourners. I said, this is really the beginning of yeshiva. You won't be able to sit at home, so sit now. And just to see that kind of like, what happens to you when you actually sit, how it changes all your relationship to the surrounding, how it allows people to suddenly to come and comfort her. Suddenly she was sitting there and like 10 of her friends were around her already being able to comfort. So that sense of sitting, whether Shiva, if you need to be comforted, or Shabbat, because it comes every week, that is also a verb. So They understand is like verbs. It's not just about doing. There's also a verb that says stop doing Shabbat. So this is a consciousness thing, because we know that in practice we do a lot of running and action and Shabbat, and maybe we can. One of the things that we learn from practices of Buddhism, which I really appreciate, is like, why don't you sit when you sit? Why don't you be quiet when it's time to be quiet? Don't allow that thing. Something that I always like to share with people who are very, very involved in projects of social justice is that if you always be in the doing, you will be actually end up burning out and you'll stop being effective. And because you have a choice, you'll stop doing it. And I've seen it in my eyes. People who like being like did wonderful things, never took a Shabbat, never stopped to sit, to reflect, to rejuvenate and to be in joy. And then they basically left and went back to America and now living nice life. We have a choice. We have a choice to either live the nice life or to be involved in helping. So remember the 6 days that there is a commandment to work and the one day that there's a commandment to stop, whether through meditation or through other, not everybody's good at meditating. And I wanna release that burden from people who think like, oh, there's Vipassana, my friends are doing, it's working for them, but it's not working for me. So find the ways to stop and reflect and to think and be less creative and more in a being way that works for you.
And I think Shabbat also, you know, it says the Gemara in the Talmud, it says that Tamid Chacham, you know, learned person is of the aspect of Shabbat all the time. And I think that it's very important, Ruth, what you're saying, because a lot of times with social action, you can also be anger is a huge motivator. Anger at the injustice in the world, and really anger also does have a place, but it can also burn you out. It can be tremendously destructive. And to find that place where you realize, on the one hand, that you have to do everything you can, but at the same time, you also know that everything is in the hands of God. That's a paradoxical place that I think is really necessary to keep going in a life that's integrates spirituality and social action.
Hmm. Have you seen that in practice in the field? Sort of have there been differences between, say, volunteers who come to work with Tevel Betzedek in Nepal, who have or are interested in a spiritual practice, and those who don't have or are not interested in a spiritual practice in terms of the way they approach the work?
I can't really say that, because sometimes the secular, you know, totally secular people not interested in spiritual practice are just amazing people and are, you know, so devoted. I don't know where they get their strength from. They have tremendous strength. What I can say is that over the years, even over the 9 years that Tevel Betzedek has been around, I've seen a real change in Israeli young people, where almost everybody now is interested in spirituality. Almost everybody is interested in meditation or in yoga, or, you know, not necessarily connected to religiosity, but very much connected to spirituality.
So speaking about religiosity when it comes to spirituality, I'm thinking a lot about the Jewish liturgy in terms of what spiritual practice can mean within our tradition. And the Jewish liturgy often strikes me as fairly particularistic, focusing on the individual or on the Jewish community. So I'm wondering for you, where do you find yourselves as people who are oriented globally, oriented towards serving humanity? What does it mean to pray Jewishly when the words that we've inherited are so often geared particularly toward the Jewish community, the Jewish people?
So I think, first of all, that one of the key things in Jewish spirituality, or in spirituality, not even Jewish, is to be able in the end to shift your identity from, you know, I'm this one person, I'm this one individual, to broaden that identity so that you identify in the end, you know, with the whole Jewish people, all of humanity, all of life, you know, and you can read almost everything in that way. You can, you know, sort of shift the reading and say, Uvenei Yerushalayim, building Jerusalem, that's building the Holy Temple, that's really building a new home for all of humanity. I mean, you can shift that reading. there also are places there. I was in the Chabad house in Kathmandu and arguing with a religious nationalist person about whether we should be helping the Nepalese, and I said, okay, I'm not gonna convince you, but so let's do the grace after meals, you know, and then we say, blessed are you, O God, who feeds everybody, who's kindness is for everybody, for the entire world. I mean, emphasize it seven times. It says Hakol, for everybody, for the totality of all of life, that's God's for. So I think that there are, in liturgy, there are a lot of places that do emphasize the universality of Judaism. Maybe not so much in the Amidah, in the 18 prayer standing meditation, maybe not as much there, but I think in the Psalms that are chosen and in the different kinds of blessings and so on and so forth. So I think that you can find it. But the other way is to put on those glasses and to read the whole tradition. Like if you say Israel, you're really talking about all the people that are connected to God in the entire world, or, you know, there's a way to read it like that. And I have to say that I've also chosen to not say certain things, like, for example, in the Havdalah prayer, in the prayer at the end of Sabbath, where they say to division, there's a division between light and darkness, holiness and unholiness, Israel and the nations of the world. I can't say that, Israel and the nations of the world, in that same way. I can't put that in. So I think there are changes and emphases in the liturgy that we have to construct.
Yeah, very much agree with what you say. There is a lot that we can find which can be interpreted as open-minded, opening the expanding the scopes. There is a really nice midrash that's been rewritten by Hasidut. They say it's a midrash, but actually it's only found in Hasidut, which he says, "Atida Eretz Yisrael shetitpashet b'chol ha'aretzot." In the future, Israel will actually, which means the holiness, the specialness of Israel, will actually seep and expand and touch all other countries. And I think we're now in this atid, we're now in this future. This is how I see it, that the same holiness that we have been trained by Judaism to treat the land of Israel is now, we should be treating the whole earth that way. At the same time, I don't want to, I live in Israel and people are speaking against other people and other traditions, other religions in a very derogatory terms. And they bring quotes from our sources and from liturgy to prove their point. This is something that I am very happy to face and to say that there's sometimes that changes must be done, not just because I'm uncomfortable with them, it's because I want to shift people's perception, and religion and prayer language is a way that shapes people's consciousness. And I cannot say things. Some things I can reread. So many nice things about Israel. You can read it as those who struggle with God. Because Jacob was struggling with angel. That's why all those who sing with God, or those who are straight with God, Yashar, Yashir, Yisar. So there's so many ways that we can interpret Israel and say every person who actually puts themselves in consciously, they're in. And that is a way of reinterpreting. But sometimes I feel I need to do more than that. And this is, like Micha said, is the changes that we do in the words of the liturgy. And in my work in Vati Ila, part of what we do, big part of what you do, is create music for prayer. And one of the things that I found out, and I've dealt with music for many years, is like when you sing something, it sticks to your memory. You remember songs and words. If you want to remember words, put them to a melody and then you'll remember them. And then they will stick to you and they'll feel comfortable. Because what is the problem with changing liturgy? It doesn't feel comfortable. So we went into the Kaddish, and I can see when people who grew up in the Orthodox tradition, they say, "Oseh shalom im ramav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu v'al kol Yisrael v'im romen," finished then. And lots of lovely melodies are there to support that. And so we wrote
quickly share with us a translation of
yes,
that.
Yes, yes. You who are creating, making, or say, you see the verb. Mm-hmm. You are the one who are verbing. You are making peace in the heaven. Tase, Yehu Yase, you will make peace down here on us and all the people Israel, and let us say amen. And we can't stay there. We can't stay with the people Israel, even though we can reinterpret the Israel, but we want to say in English, from Native American sentiment, that it's all sentient beings. But we want to use a language that is found in the Tehillim. It feels ours. So what the people have chosen is Al Kol Yoshvei Tevel, all those who inhabit this universe. So we wrote music to it. And your music is written in the way that you have to sing Al Kol Yoshvei Tevel, otherwise you have to stop the melody in the middle, and that you can't do. The same thing with the Havdalah. We wrote music for the Havdalah that doesn't leave space for Bin Israel Amim. So when you sing it that way, you can't put it in. It doesn't feel comfortable. And that, in this way, we're actually creating a felt, sense, visceral, audio, verbal, rendition of tradition. And those melodies are sung all over the world, and there will be a whole generation of people that when they think about it, they think that Al Kol Yoshvei Tevel has to be there, and then they look at the Siddur and they say, oh, they forgot to include that part. How weird.
They forgot the rest of the nations.
So this is us as agents of change. You know, we are agents of change in the field by doing those projects, but we're agent of change in prayer practice.
And the other hand, though, I would say that, like, say the Vanu Vacharta, that's a big dilemma for me. So some people say because you have chosen us. So some people say with all the nations, but for me, it's also important to say that it's right and it's okay for us to say we are a people that were touched by God. We've been touched by God throughout history and at Sinai and whatever it is. As long as it doesn't mean that no other people has been touched by God. For all I know, every people has been touched by God, or some people have been touched by God. But I don't think that universalism means denying our own inner experience as a people, and realizing that as a people we have been a vessel for God coming into the world in a unique way. So we have to hold both those things together.
So we're coming to the end of our time here. I wanted to ask one more question, which is, if I'm listening to this conversation right now and I'm looking to integrate my spiritual practice and my pursuit of global justice, where would you suggest that I start that journey?
You say you have a spiritual practice?
Good question.
I think these are two things that every adult should cultivate, which is like I cultivate my spiritual practice and I cultivate my involvement in society. The way we live, it's not predestined, you know? It's like, this is the only way that you should do your spiritual practice. We have choice. We live in a world of choice. And I say choose and try and see what works for you, what is authentic into your life, both in the way of the giving and the way of cultivating your own practice. The both things that you have to do, you have to put thinking, you have to put effort. There will be trial and error. Sometimes you do things like intensive, like going to Nepal for 7 months, but you don't stay there the whole year, all of your life. So when you come back, what do you do? How do you bring that kind of education into your life? It's like going to a retreat, a Vipassana retreat. You come back. How do you bring that taste of what you have done in a retreat into your life? I think that for a lot of people, it's important to do intensive. It's important to build a life that will contain taste of those intensives in your life. And you should, every few years, you should do an intensive like that, because this really brings you into in touch with all your resistance, with all your growth that you need to be doing. And then it's maybe it's like the Shabbat in the week, you know. We have Shabbat once a week and the sabbatical once in 7 years. And then how do you bring the same Shemitah consciousness, Shabbat consciousness, Tevel B'Tzedek consciousness into your life as a person with family, with job, with friends, with lots of things to deal with. But never forget that consciousness. Always find a room for it.
So I would say that, you know, the Baal Shem Tov says that when you pray, you really shouldn't be praying for yourself. You should be praying for what Ruth was talking about before, uplifting the Shekhinah, the presence of God in this world. And that should be the main focus of your prayers. On the other hand, Rabbi Nachman says, pray for every little thing. If your shoelace is ripped, pray to find a new shoelace. And I think that you need, in the prayer level, you need both things. So I think that you need to have a practice where, like I'm trying now, like in Shacharit, I try and pray just for the world, not for myself. And then at Mincha, if I'm lucky enough to remember to do Mincha, so I try to pray for, you know, for all those personal things. So I think one thing would be to develop a spiritual practice where you are praying and identifying with the whole world and understanding that your fate is not separate from everything else, from all of life, from the whole of cosmos that's trying to reach up and meet God and bring God into the world. And on the social justice level, I think the same things hold true, that on the one hand, I think it's very important to look at the global trends. Like for me, it was very important to look at what is the current form of economic globalization, neoliberal economic globalization, what does it mean and how is it working as a system and how is it creating poverty or wealth? I personally am not a big fan, but, you know, but to look at that systematically and understand those things, whether it's environment, whether it's economics. At the same time, I think it's important to remember that Ein ata yodea shcharan shel mitzvot. You don't know what the reward is for a mitzvah. So it could be, you know, and this is part of chaos theory, it's actually part of science now. You don't know. Taking care of, you know, a sick friend could actually be as important as starting a global advocacy campaign against, you know, climate change. You really don't know. So you need to hold both those things together, you know, at the same time.
Thank you both so much for joining us and for sharing your wisdom.
Thank you for the invitation. It was wonderful.
Yeah,
it was to great. Have this discussion.
It's great.
Tada rabba.
Ose shalom bimomav.
And that's today's show. Tune in to upcoming episodes exploring more questions at the intersection of Jewish history, tradition, and values, and the practice of global citizenship and service. Global Torah is made possible through a partnership between the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and Olam. Special thanks to Rabbi Dr. Mishhammer Kassoy, Diana Ginsberg, Louise Sherb, Ben Wallach, and Seth Samuel, and to our guests, Rabbi Ruth Gon-Kagan and Rabbi Micha Odenheimer, for joining us today. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. You can learn more and hear this episode again at pardes.org.il and at olamtogether.org.